This little epistle of 1 Peter, it's one of the grandest little books in the New Testament. Martin Luther wrote that it is one of the noblest books in the New Testament, he said, because it is genuine and pure gospel. 1 Peter only contains 105 verses. So, June, you read about 10% of the epistle to us this morning. This epistle contains the gospel. I mean, if you really want to know what the gospel is, to summarize the gospel of Jesus Christ, read 1 Peter. I love 1 Peter. And I'll tell you one reason why. Because Peter is not Paul. The Apostle Paul, bless his heart, he can get a little ornery at times, can't he? I mean, Paul is somebody that is hard to understand. He can be ornery. If Paul gets a burr under his saddle, you better watch out, because he's going to tell you exactly what he thinks. Now, we all love the Apostle Paul of 1 Corinthians 13 when he climbs to the very top of the mountain of rhetorical and theological eloquence. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, love is patient and kind. He writes, it's not jealous or boastful, it's not irritable or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. Now that's the Apostle Paul that we love. But if you turn over to 2 Corinthians 13, you find the Apostle Paul who said, I warn those who sinned before and all the others, and I warn them now while I am absent as I did before my visit. If I come again, I will not spare you. Somehow I can hear my mother's voice. Just wait until your father gets home. I mean, that's the Apostle Paul that can be a little ornery at times. But Peter's not like that. Peter is writing to Christians who have the same problems that Paul's readers have. They have the same shortcomings, the same sins, but he decides to go about it a different way. Peter decides, rather than focus on their sins and their shortcomings, he's going to praise them for their faith. Rather than kick them when they're down, he's going to lift them up. He's going to rush in and pat them on the back, saying, you're doing a good job, keep the faith. Rather than criticize them for their weaknesses, he's praising them for their standing in Christ, because he knows these people are going through some terrible times. Some of the readers of 1 Peter are slaves, and they undergo terrible beatings from their master. Being a Christian in these days was not easy. In fact, it was one of the most difficult things, because Christians were maligned by mainstream society. Christians were verbally abused and even physically abused. Peter doesn't want to add to their burden by making them feel like they've failed, but he wants to boost their confidence. He wants to inspire them to keep the faith, to keep believing, to never give up in spite of suffering, in spite of hardship, in spite of sickness. Whatever's going on in your life, he said, you keep the faith. And he does this by writing this beautiful hymn of praise. That's the words that June shared with us. It's praise for the gift of salvation. He begins by saying, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. By His great mercy, we have been born anew to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And then to those people who were struggling, he said, don't give up because you have something glorious to look forward to. You have an inheritance, and this inheritance is imperishable, it is undefiled, it is unfading, and it is kept in heaven for you. This inspires hope for so many people. The African-American spirituals were based on this concept. In spite of all the difficulties, in spite of the slavery that they found themselves in, they could sing. They could sing about looking over Jordan. I looked over Jordan, and what did I see coming far to carry me home? To carry me home to this wonderful place where an inheritance is waiting for me, and there is nothing that can happen to make that perishable or fade away. And then he goes on and he talks about rejoicing. He talks about even though you're going through a tough time, you continue to rejoice because you will always rebound with faith in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And even though you've never seen him, you love him. Oh, how I love Jesus because he first loved me. And then he has this great statement in the 9th verse. The outcome of your faith, Peter writes, is the salvation of your soul. He adds a few more things that I find to be absolutely fascinating at this point. In verses 10 through 12, he begins by talking about the prophets. He said, this gift of salvation, this glorious transformation that you have experienced, is something that the prophets of old searched for. They prophesied about this, but they could never experience. You go back to Isaiah, to Jeremiah, to Ezekiel, to Hosea, to Amos, to Micah. They were looking forward to this day, but they never experienced it. And then he adds another just profound statement. He said, your salvation is such a great gift that even the angels of heaven long to look to experience what you have experienced. This is the picture. If you can see a bunch of angels in heaven, they're looking over. They're standing on the very threshold, and they're looking over, hoping to get a glimpse of the beauty of the gift of salvation. Do you understand what this is saying to us? That we have such a great gift, something the prophets never experienced, something the angels of heaven have never experienced. It's what we have. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that glorious? That's what he's telling us. On the morning of May the 24th, 1738, an Anglican priest by the name of John Wesley read these words, the very words that June read. And then he turned over to 2 Peter, and he read, there are given unto us exceeding great and precious promises, even that ye should be partakers of the divine nature. But this Anglican priest was depressed. Even though he was a priest, even though he preached, he could not share in that glory. He didn't know what Peter was talking about, this great gift of salvation that you may rebound with praise and honor and glory, that you love Jesus even though you've never seen Jesus. He couldn't identify with any of that. His heart was heavy. His heart was not uplifted. He didn't understand about waiting for this divine inheritance, much less angels longing to look at what he had because he did not have it. That evening, a still depressed John Wesley, unwillingly, he wrote, attended a Christian meeting in Aldersgate in London. And that night, someone read Martin Luther's preface to the book of Romans. And as they were reading this, John Wesley said something deep and dramatic took place. 200 years before, a Catholic priest by the name of Martin Luther felt exactly like John Wesley. He did not have any sense of joy. He read passages like this, but he couldn't identify with them. In fact, the first time that Martin Luther administered communion, the first time he held the elements as a priest, he started to tremble. He started to shake. He could not perform his duties because he understood the concept that he was inviting people into the presence of a holy and a righteous God, and he was of all men most unrighteous, most unholy. He was not worthy. And Martin Luther, a man who we know suffered from depression, and the depression coupled with this sense of unworthiness led him to spend hours and hours and hours in the confession booth. In the monastery, they said he wore the priest out. It's like, oh no, here he comes again. Martin Luther marching into the booth, confessing for hours and hours and hours, because he just couldn't understand how we who are sinful could be counted righteous in the eyes of God. And then Martin Luther, the one thing a lot of people don't know about Luther is the guy was a brilliant scholar. Anybody who can translate the New Testament from Greek into German in a few short months is brilliant. And that's what Luther did, and that translation to this very day is still used in Germany. But Martin Luther said he was trying to understand this concept about how we could be righteous before God, how the just can live by faith. The fact that he was a brilliant scholar, he was studying the New Testament in the Greek. And at the same time of Martin Luther, there was a man by the name of Erasmus. And Erasmus was probably the most brilliant Greek scholar of his day. Erasmus helped him to understand that the concept of righteousness is not just the state of being righteous, but it is also the state of being declared righteous. And that was the moment that the light came on. That was the moment that the bell started ringing, because he understood, I will never be good enough. I will never be righteous, but God, who is righteous, can declare me righteous. And this is what he wrote. He wrote that when he grasped that concept, he said, I felt myself to be reborn and to have gone through the gates into paradise. 2 centuries later, someone is reading his preface to the book of Romans, in which he's talking about this, that faith is a divine work in us. It's not what we do, it is what God does through us. It was that moment that John Wesley's heart was strangely warmed, and he experienced a deep and dramatic conversion. 2 years ago, many of us were studying the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. In our Monday night, Tuesday morning, Thursday morning Bible studies, we were talking about this. And it was about the same time that I started planning for our sabbatical. And I knew that one of the first places I wanted to go was to Wittenberg in Germany, where the Reformation started. So I started looking for a place to stay. And I found this remarkable old house by the name of Alt Kanzlei. The Alt Kanzlei was built in the 12th century when Columbus sailed the ocean blue in what year? You still know it, don't you? 1492. This house was over 100 years old. It predated the Reformation by 125 years. It was called Alt Kanzlei, means old chancellery. And this had been the home to Saxon kings, including one by the name of Frederick the Wise. If you remember from our study, Frederick the Wise was the prince who protected Martin Luther. If it had not been for Frederick the Wise, we would have never heard the name of Martin Luther. But when the Reformation started, a man by the name of Justus Jonas purchased this house. He was a scholar in biblical languages, and he became the chancellor at the University of Wittenberg, where Martin Luther was a professor. Martin Luther had what he called his kitchen cabinet. It was Philip Melanchthon, it was Justin Jonas and himself. They spent hours and hours and hours over the kitchen table in the home of Justus Jonas. And this is where we were staying. This little hotel only has 9 rooms, and each room was named for a different reformer. When we arrived there and we went into our room, I looked out the window, and there was the castle church. And I was looking at the doors where Martin Luther posted the 95 Theses 502 years ago. And when we went to eat, we were eating in the same room where Luther and Melanchthon and Jonas were talking about the Reformation and planning strategy for the Reformation. Joyce can tell you I was like a kid in a candy shop. She couldn't get me to go to bed at night. Come on, I'm looking out the window. I just had to see that sight. It was just remarkable. I don't know that I've ever been anywhere where we were more inspired. We saw the pulpit where Martin Luther preached over 2,000 sermons. We saw one of the first editions of the German Bible that he translated. We saw one of the first hymn books, the first one to have the hymn, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." And Joyce and I joined a number of other Christians, and in the castle church we worshiped together and we sang that glorious, glorious hymn. I think you can say that the pivotal moment in Western civilization happened at those doors. And that's why I was so excited. Now, some of you may say, now, what is all this fuss about? We're not Lutherans. Well, let me tell you what all the fuss is about. Because 200 years after Martin Luther, the preface to the book of Romans was read, and John Wesley becomes a Christian. One of the converts of John Wesley was William Wilberforce. You recognize the name? He became the leader in the movement to abolish slavery in the British Empire, a movement that flowed over to the American colonies, the abolitionist movement. Another man who was converted by John Wesley was the great evangelist who started the Great Awakening in the United States, George Whitefield. George Whitefield was responsible for the spiritual movement going on in the American colonies. And one of the converts of his crusades was a lady whose last name was Henry. And she had a son named Patrick. Patrick Henry was influenced by George Whitefield. And when Patrick Henry stood in Richmond, Virginia, and said, "But as for me, give me liberty or give me death," those words reverberated back to George Whitefield, reverberated back to John Wesley, reverberated back to Martin Luther. And it all happened right there. There's one more event that took place in front of those doors. In 1934, a Baptist minister by the name of Michael from Atlanta, Georgia, went with another group of ministers to the Holy Land. They walked where Jesus walked. And on the way back, they stopped in Berlin, Germany, at the meeting of the Baptist World Alliance. One day, the minister said, "Let's go to Wittenberg. Let's go and see where the Reformation started." When Michael, the Baptist minister, was standing in front of those doors, he became so inspired that he decided to change his name from Michael to Martin Luther. Michael King Sr. came back to the United States and changed his name to Martin Luther King Sr. and his son's name to Martin Luther King Jr. And he led the greatest Reformation of the 20th century. And by the way, the room that we were in was the Martin Luther King room. When we were checking out, our host, the hotel manager, was such a kind and a gracious man. He did everything to make us comfortable. He told us about places we needed to visit. He was there early in the morning and late at night. He did everything you could ask a host to do. I remember checking out, and his office, it was a beautiful day. The door was open, and you could look over and see the chapel doors. And I was telling him what a wonderful experience we had. And even though the room we were in was the Martin Luther King room, he did not know the story that I just told you. So I was telling him that story. I said, "You know, it happened right there, right across the street." And then he told me, one of the saddest things I've ever heard in my life. He looked at me and he said, "When I see people like you, I can see your passion. I can feel the excitement in your voice. I know that you have a strong faith, and I see it all the time with people who come here because of their faith." And then he said, "But I have no faith." I don't know if you knew, but Wittenberg was behind the Iron Curtain. It was ruled by the communists. And our host told us, he said, "Growing up, we were communists. We didn't go to church." He said, "I've never been able to confess my faith. I don't understand what you're talking about." But he could see it like the angels looking over, longing to experience what we have. He said, "I wish I could have what you have." Isn't that sad? course, I thought, okay, I need to come up with something really profound to tell him. I'm a preacher. I was blown away. I did tell him. I said, you know, it's never too late. It's never too late to experience this. And then he pointed to his heart and he said, I know. It's in my heart. But do you see what we have? Do you see this grand and this glorious gift of salvation? That someone like our host in Germany, he could see the difference in our lives. And he wanted that for his life. The prophets of old searched for this but never experienced it. And even the angels of heaven long to look at the gift that we have received. I stand amazed in the presence of Jesus the Nazarene. Let us be thankful for this gift.